Welcome to Let's Talk Hope, giving a voice to the unheard. Today we're joined by Claire LaRocque, who's a senior suicide prevention therapist from James Place. And we're joined by Trish, who's the mom of a young man who's used the service. And we're also joined by Paul, our podcast producer, who is a parent of an autistic child with ADHD. So thank you everyone for joining today. We're going to be talking about a really important topic today with young people, to do with neurodiversity, to do with young men accessing services as well. So Claire, we've obviously had James's Place in here before, just talking about the service and that it's aimed at men who are in suicidal crisis. And recently you started a pilot service for 16 to 17 year olds. So could you just talk us through what kind of motivated that and how it's been setting up that service?
I think how it started is that we did see that there was a gap in support for 16 to 17 year olds, especially accessing suicide prevention. Obviously, you know, at James's Place, we've been there since 2018, supporting men 18 and over. But there was this gap of where do 16 to 17 year olds go to get that kind of support. At the time, it was Jane Boland, who was our head of centre, who was meeting with Alderhay Hospital as well as YPASS with regard to setting up a pilot with regards to 16 to 17 year olds. So the family of a young boy, Max Windell, who died by suicide, they came on board with James's Place and they funded a pilot programme, and that was geared specifically towards 16 to 17 year olds of boys in suicidal crisis. So that was back in, I think it was about 2023 when it was first thought about. And then we worked quite a lot with Alderhay Hospital, the crisis team, about getting them to refer the young boys into the service at James's Place.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for telling us about that. And Trish, if you could let us know about how you heard about James's Place.
So going back into January, my son had been having about a depression, which he'd only really started mentioning in December, but he descended into depression really quite quickly. And of course, with it being Christmas, getting in their doctors and anything like that, and he's got a lifetime condition, that means he's under Alderhay past 16. I was trying to bring appointments forward, but unfortunately, he had a bad night. A simple conversation with somebody online resulted in him overdosing on his own medication. So luckily enough, I found him and he told me what he'd done. We go straight to Alderhay and they dealt with the medical side of it with the medication. And then we were told to wait to speak to CAMHS. And then there was a little bit of an issue and CAMHS in Alderhay sent us to Whiston. So we spent the day at Whiston waiting to be assessed. And then at 6 o'clock we got assessed and then sent home. And that was sort of where we sort of left with phone calls. And yeah. Then eventually, about 3 days later, we were asked to come back into CAMHS in Alderhay. And the lovely nurse there came around and said, I think I know the place where he needs to go and he needs a referral now. And lucky enough, next day she got into contact with James's Place, spoke to Claire that day, and about 2 days later she had an appointment. And that was a huge step.
Yeah, well, sorry to hear about that and that you went through that experience. And just to understand, why were you referred from Alderhay to Whiston? Is that to do with his age?
I think it was to do with his age. I think there was a little bit of not understanding. It was in the middle of the night, whether or not they should be dealing with him or whether Whiston should be dealing with him because of his age and because of that confusion. It made a long day very long.
Definitely.
And it made it worse. There was snow on the ground, so the people who could have assessed him early couldn't get in and they were short staffed. So we literally had to spend from 8 o'clock in the morning till gone past seven in Whiston before getting home. And it was a basic assessment. You know, it was tick list. And there's nothing else they could do. And then we went home and we were literally left adrift. Because if he'd had a broken leg, they'd have put a cast on, on it. Yep. If he'd had a heart attack, he would have had medication. It needed stitches, they would have sewn him. But his soul was broken. Yeah. And there was nothing. I mean, everybody offered help. I can't say that people weren't ringing up because people did to offer help. But when you're a parent in that situation, you don't know what help it is and you do not know what to ask for or where to get. There was no guidance. There was no leaflet. There was leaflets to say if he does this or if they do this, you go here or ring this number. You know, if he does anything else, you go straight back to A&E. But just how to live.
Yeah. And actually, we do a lot of work with schools at the moment. And even they were saying when a young person has attempted on their life, there's no information for, you know, the schools or the families on how to deal with that. There's some coming through for postvention or, like you say, where to contact, but there's not that kind of information. So I think that's a really good point you've brought up. So you said then a couple of days later, a nurse told you about James's place and you were referred in.
Another CAM supporter came in and she went through the same checklist that my son was just saying, it just isn't. You know, what's the point of asking me these questions? And when he said, well, we're going to do this referral, he was like, why? You know, what are they going to do?
I remember his welcome assessment. I think he'd just given up by then, hadn't he? Yeah. Like, there's no point me even talking to this person because nothing's going to help.
Yeah.
He was really, really defeated, weren't he?
Yeah. His whole, honestly, he was just like a shell.
Yeah.
And he'd just been asked the same questions repeatedly, but nothing else was coming. And to be fair, when Claire came out with their cards, for about 15 minutes, I was totally... a bit skeptical here. I'm not convinced this is going to work. And my lad was looking at me going,
it's not
going
to work.
And by some magic, she got the cards out. They were discussing. It was such an easy prompt for him to start opening up that he did start relaxing. And the initial assessment went really well. She said, yeah, you know, come back next week. But we had a foundation because with them cards, I could take a picture and take them home and then start working on what his thought processes was, because he didn't have the vocabulary to express what is wrong with him. But Claire slowly pulled it out bit by bit.
But I think what really helps with the young people that we did support, as much as 9 out of 10 times, they did have another parent in the room, and it really, really helped having that. He felt really supported by you being there. And I felt like I was getting support somehow because you were there to kind of like vouch for the work that I was doing. So I think that because you were so heavily involved in his treatment with us, you know, the success that he had was, I mean, it weren't immediate.
No.
Because you did have to goad him quite a few times, or you had to ask him, prompt him, go on, you need to talk to Claire. Because, you know, talking therapy doesn't work if you don't talk. You had to goad him quite a lot of the times about, okay, so what do you think about this? Now, we did use the cards, and we use the cards in every single session that we use. So obviously, you know about the lay your card on the table.
I was about to say, for anyone who's listening, would you mind just telling us a little bit about, you know, the kind of model that you're using with them?
Yeah, so part and parcel of the intervention that we use at James's place is this lay your cards on the table. And the people who use the cards, as in the people like myself, that we know, you know, everything behind them. The people like your son who use the cards are very unaware that there is like a psychological formulation behind the cards for us to be able to get to the root of the issues sooner rather than later. You know, we're working with people who are in a suicidal crisis, so we haven't got the luxury of time. We need to get to the point of it sooner rather than later. So that's what really helped with your son and everybody else who uses the intervention with us. So having you in the room with him was really, really beneficial, because apart from the fact, you know, he trusts you're his mum. You know, he's got no more trust than anybody else than he has with yourself and obviously the wider family. So you supporting him through it just made the journey for him, I think, a lot easier.
Well, picking up on that point, I was really surprised actually when you were both talking about the fact that you were in the room, because it's that kind of age, isn't it, where are you still including parents that you're not? And then obviously we hear about carers for adult children who obviously have the decision making to say that they don't necessarily want parents to know anything or partners. But something that's come through in conversations with people, speaking with services about their children who might be in suicidal crisis, is feeling like sometimes, you know, they're being blamed for some of what's going on and also being excluded from some of the conversations that are happening. So I think that's really interesting that you've talked about the fact that it was actually really beneficial for the parent and your son in this case to have you both in there, and how that maybe supported outside of the sessions as well. So I don't know if you could speak a bit more about that.
Every session we gave my lad the chance, right? Do you want me here or do you want me upstairs? And it was discussed. I've got no problem waiting, but do you want to go? And he go, no, mum, come with. Because the conversations we'd have to have on the way home, like, they were heartbreaking, but it's so much easier talking, walking, you know, with everything else is so busy, just to be able to nitpick everything else. And I mean, on the way to the first session, it was probably one of the hardest conversations. He's going, well, why are we going here? And having to say to him, son, you're broken and I don't know how to fix you. I need somebody who does. Mm. And I hit him hard because, you know, mums and dads know how to do everything. And when I was like, I don't know what to do. Because we'd gone through over a week of him being tired, obviously emotional at times, trying to keep him on track. He was doing his A-levels at home because he'd done it just during A-level week. So luckily enough, the college that he was in was really supportive, and they sent, you know, a member of staff out to invigilate so he could do his A-levels. So it wasn't behind.
Yeah.
You know, but trying to keep him level-footed, you know, it's trying to keep him level-headed to try and do this while saying it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as a parent to teenagers as well, I think sometimes being honest with them and actually telling them when you can't do something or you're too tired or you're not in the right headspace yourself can actually be good for them to know that sometimes that we need help as well. And, you know, sometimes we do have to go and get the help elsewhere for all of us. So that's really interesting. And even the bit where you said about talking there and back, I've heard that with other services that can be the really crucial times. I mean, we all laugh, don't we, when we pick up our kids from school, or that can be sometimes the only conversation you get out of them, or at bedtime when they don't want to go to sleep anymore. But yeah, no, really interesting. Just another point, Claire, I wanted to come back to as well is, you know, we've had some conversations where we've spoken about a lot of men, whether they're adults, using the service where neurodiversities come in. It wasn't something we spoke about when the service was set up. It wasn't something we thought about collecting data on. But with the young people, I've heard it's even more prevalent.
Yes.
Is there anything you could share about that?
That is one thing that stood out for me was, you know, it was only over a year, well, 18 months, like the pilot as a whole. But out of all the young people that were referred to us and who we did support, I'd say it was about 90% of them had a neurodiverse diagnosis. So it weren't just they might or they might not be, but they were diagnosed with neurodiverse condition. So that was something that was really, really prevalent kind of thing to myself. And another thing with the young people that I really noticed, and again, I don't know if this is to do with people who are neurodivergent, that the entrapment levels were a lot lower than our 18 plus. So all the work that we do, and you know yourself that your son would have filled in some questionnaires beforehand. So one was the core 10 and one was the ESF, the entrapment short form. And it was really noticeable on the ESF form that the levels were, say, 2 out of 16, whereas the 18 plus, when they come into James's Place, they're on 14 to 16 out of 16. I don't know if that's got to do with being neurodivergent or if it's something to do with the age.
Really interesting, actually. And, you know, Paul, just speaking to you as a parent of neurodivergent child, I know you've recently written to the Health and Education Secretaries and the Chief Executive of NHS England because of your experiences of trying to use some services. Could you share a little bit with us about that?
Yeah, so our son, concerns were first raised when he was 3 years old in nursery. And we were sort of aware of ADHD, we'd heard of it, and we'd noticed some differences with him and with his older siblings, and he's a twin as well, so I always used to joke that we had our scientific control there. But then the first time someone else noticed something was when my wife was picking the twins up from nursery, and one of the nursery staff pulled us one side and just, you know, asked if there are any things that, you know, worked well at home, you know, because he was being a bit impulsive and some of the other kids were a little bit wary of him at times. And I think she just burst into tears because that was the first time someone other than us, you know, an external person had said something. So sort of the nagging thought in the back of our minds, you know, became a bit more real. It was, you know, being spoken about. So he started having some assessments, but then lockdown happened. So I think he was meant to have three. He just had the first one. And then they were at home for months and months and months then, and then started reception. So, you know, when we started on a reception, we were like, well, can this carry on now, please? I said, oh, no, it's a different team now. So everything was wiped. And we had to go back to square one. But it was worse than that. We couldn't go back to square one. We weren't allowed to be on square one until school also noticed a problem, because now it's all different and you have to have the questionnaire filled out, you know, by school and by parents and notice it in two different settings, etc. And he was doing remarkably well and, you know, he was masking, we now know. And it was not for several years that we sort of managed to get the ball rolling again. And to cut a very long story short, it took us 6 years and a failed. We got to the end of the pathway once when they hadn't even seen him, just based on a questionnaire. And they said, no, we don't think he's got ADHD, which is hilarious, really, because anyone who's ever spent more than 30 seconds with him could instantly tell. And then so we had to wait 6 months and re-refer. And we only got the diagnosis in the end because I had to bang my drum and you know, complain to the chief exec of Alder Hey that, you know, things were getting ignored and no progress and things, because they say that they can prioritise if it's seen as an emergency case, you know, when a kid's been suspended three times and is, you know, clearly not coping. I'd say that is quite an important case. So yeah, we've just had, I mean, we're still in the thick of it, an experience where it took us 6 years to get a diagnosis. But, you know, as I said before we started recording, we've only got a piece of paper. We've not got any meaningful help and support. Getting referred into CAMHS is, you know, like getting blood out of a stone. And then they often just pass to someone else who passed a YPASS who say, oh, there's nothing we can do. The knee-jerk reaction seems to be, like, you know, blame the parents, you know, just say that it's your responsibility to sort. It must be something wrong you're doing at home. Send them on a parenting course, which, you know, we're not perfect parents by any stretch of the imagination. And parenting courses can be helpful and have lots of useful things in, but that's not the answer. You know, when there's a serious neurodevelopmental condition, there are physical aspects that go alongside it as well. We've had to pay privately an absolute fortune for a private OT assessment, which has uncovered some really interesting physical things, which are all linking in. But yeah, just not getting taken seriously, constantly being told to wait, to wait, to wait. But you know, irreparable damage is already being done. So much for early intervention. It's like they'll only do anything when it's already too late.
Yeah, so. And definitely. And I went on some suicide prevention training courses and I was really surprised actually with how many parents were on the course. Usually it was for teenagers, but how many spoke about very similar issues to what you've brought up today is, you know, maybe eventually there was a neurodiverse condition as well diagnosed, but how much kind of was put back on the parents. I think it's been really brilliant to hear about the kind of co-production that you've had at James Place. But Trish, just to come back to you, I mean, was that the first time you'd been to hospital? And what have your experiences been? You know, have you had some better experiences with services?
My son has a medical condition and the hospital, Alder Hey, we're fantastic with that because it's a clear-cut medical condition. You know, there was something wrong with him. We give him the medicine, we review. They review regularly and his team are amazing for that condition. When he was getting depressed, trying to get help that way wasn't so easy because they didn't know, well, was he depressed because of his condition or was he just depressed? You'll have to wait till the next review. And that was frustrating.
Could I ask what age he was when he, you know, when they started to assess him for potentially for depression?
He was 17.
17.
It was literally after he tried to kill himself.
Yeah, yeah. And then obviously you said you'd been sent to Whiston and you were kind of toing and froing a little bit. But then thankfully, within a couple of days, you were introduced to James's Place.
We were.
I suppose, what would you say, both of you and even Paul, you know, as a parent of a child who is going to be getting older and may potentially need services like this, what would you all say from your own perspectives about needing services like this in the community?
Personally, I think every child that turns up, and I'm saying child, he's a young man, but he was still a child. And he's in that age grade, like you said, 16 to 18, where he could make his own decisions, where he couldn't actually make this decision. He wasn't in a mental headspace to make this decision. Every child or young person who turns up in A&E should automatically be referred to a place like James's Place.
Yeah.
Straight away, no to and fro, and not to keep doing the same base assessment. They should automatically be, because for that, the 10 days we waited over the weekends and everything, we didn't know what we were doing. He didn't know what he was doing. Were all the offers of help, there was no help, if that makes any sense. Even though I had an amazing school nurse phone up and checking up on us, his school dash college was brilliant. They kept the best they could do. But it was clear he turned around and said, actually, the physical state of him is just a reaction to what he's done. The tiredness is perfectly normal. Yeah. You know, don't be panicking about that. He just needs to work through it. No one else had told me that. You know, we were thinking, is there something else wrong? That was like huge. It was like a bit of a relief. It's okay. This is just part of a stage of a process that we need to go through. I don't think that anybody who's made these decisions has lived with a child who's done what my son did and be that close to losing him and to be that scared of losing him and not have a support system in place. Well, the people who make them decisions should be absolutely disgusted with themselves, because I was lucky and my son was lucky, but some other parents aren't. Do you know? I mean, if it'd been like this January, my lad wouldn't have had a chance. And he needed this. He couldn't wait for CAMHS. He couldn't wait for an appointment system. He needed it there and then.
And then. Yeah. It was a while, wasn't it? Because I know over the summer holidays when you messaged me about him getting his A-levels and you said that he'd just been offered his appointment in CAMHS.
Yeah.
And that was
August.
8-9 months later.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, all the research, you know, that I've been doing, I mean, I think I've been kind of saying this since I finished my PhD back in 2015. That's what motivated helping with setting up a place like James's Place, is we need help for people. As soon as they say I'm in crisis, that should be enough. No one should have to prove it or say anything else, but we haven't got the right services, but they're growing, and we have got places like James's Place and many others that we've got listed on our support that we signpost for, thankfully, but there's not enough funding.
And it makes financial sense as well, which shouldn't be a consideration, but if you know, put your, you know, cold government minister hat on and think purely financially, because at the moment what happens is someone says they're in crisis and the system says, well, that's okay. If you could just mind pressing pause on your crisis for 2-3 years, then, you know, we might help you. But real world doesn't work like that, you know. Sometimes things are urgent and, you know, you need help right now. You can't wait even a week. And one of the points I made in the open letter that I wrote was that, you know, the financial cost of this is absurd as well, because all these, you know, children and young people are being left and abandoned. And then the cost to society of, you know, increases in the criminal justice system and, you know, risky behavior and other things. And, you know, people drifting into adulthood, you know, and not being able to find work, and then, you know, cost of the benefit system. So although it's a horrible way to think about it, but if you think about it purely financially, it makes perfect sense to put more funding into early help rather than just completely abandoning people. I did some training recently as part of a role I have as a governor at a specialist college, and we had to do domestic abuse training, and under one of the definitions of domestic abuse and abandonment is not providing adequate medical care. So I don't think it's much of a stretch at all to say that the system is literally abusing children and young people by abandoning them and withholding medical care from them when they urgently need it. And like you said, if it was a physical issue, you know, if you have a slightly achy shoulder, which, you know, is a pain, but I'm sure we could all live with, something as minor as a slightly achy shoulder, you'll get given pain relief straight away. I mean, paracetamol, you can just walk into a pharmacy and buy it. You'll be seen, I think the targets, don't quote me on this, but I think the target's like 8 weeks to be seen for that. You know, that's a legally binding target that you must be seen within such a short period of time. And then you'll probably start treatment the next week. And that's for something as minor as, my shoulder's a bit achy, but a completely debilitating, life-limiting condition, because it's not seen as, you know, physical, you're just abandoned. And especially if it's with a child who's young enough, then all of the onus is put on the parents. There's no direct help for the child. It's You know, if they're under a certain age, well, the only solution is giving the parents a leaflet or sending them on a course or telling them to manage it. You know, if my child had a brain tumour, I wouldn't be sent a big leaflet textbook on, you know, how to become a brain surgeon. You know, the professionals who actually know what they're doing would help, you know, rather than that the parents being told to help. And there are so many little grey areas where if you're, you know, a certain age, then, you know, you don't qualify. Like we were at YPASS with our son the other week, and because he's not yet 10, there are all these things that he can't yet access. You know, why should his age make a difference?
No.
You know, if you can just wait another 6 months, you know, for his 10th birthday, then you can access this. But in 6 months' time, 6 months' worth of damage will have been added.
A long time, isn't it? I have to wait.
It is. And there are such strict things about age. I mean, I know we're talking about young boys here, but I saw something on menopause the other day where until you reach 45, even if you've got every symptom under the sun, at, you know, 44 point something, nothing's going to happen. And even myself, the day I turned 45 and I went in, the nurse was like, oh, you're 45 now.
We'll look at you. And, we'll speak to you.
The conversation changed, but it shouldn't be like
it's
that even.
Yeah.
And then we've got this gap that unfortunately your son fell into as well, this 16, 17 year old gap that we hear about all the time. I've heard from one friend whose daughter unfortunately overdosed, who then had to go to the Royal, and it was a week after her 16th birthday, and I think she was so traumatized by what she saw in the waiting room with a lot of adult men coming in at, you know, Friday night, I think it was, and there was some urinating in the changing room or some of the behaviors and even some of the physical wounds.
You don't want to be there as an adult, never mind as a child.
It was really distressing. So I think there's a lot to be said about kind of the provision for that age group that just isn't meeting their needs.
Well, I was very lucky when we did get to Whiston. I spoke to a lady at the desk, and to the side on the side of me, there was just a waiting room full of people. And the lady just looked at me and said, "How old is he?" And I told him. She said, "Well, he's still young enough to go to our child department there." And there was about three children in there. Now, he felt awkward because, you know, there was Disney pictures and, you know, the kids and the kids' cartoons on and stuff. But he couldn't have managed being in that room. He couldn't have done that waiting room at all. Trying to keep him there would have been very difficult. His stress levels would have just gone out the roof. He wouldn't have been able to cope with so many people, the noise, the heat. So we sat half the day in a children's waiting area, which wasn't the right one, but it was a better one.
Yeah. And we hear that men, you know, and I'm sure young men as well, are more likely to leave A&E before they're seen as well, because when they do see all of that around them, either it's too chaotic for them to stay or they don't feel like they're in the right place. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I did exactly that when I went to the Royal A&E. It was my first time in the new Royal. And it wasn't COVID, but it was something similar to COVID. And I was having, you know, really bad breathing difficulties. And my wife's a healthcare professional, and she got her OBS kit out and checked me. And she said, "Look, if you were a patient, I'd be phoning an ambulance right now." And I did the typical man thing of, "Oh, I'm sure it's not that bad." But she persuaded me to phone 111. And then they then said, "You know, yeah, you should, you know, I'll either phone you an ambulance or can you make your way to A&E?" But it was either a Friday or Saturday night. I had breathing difficulties and it was so stuffy in there that I could hardly breathe. And, you know, like you said, the other sort of clientele at that time of night coming in. And then I was finally seen. And then when they said it'll be about 8 hours, I was like, well, sod that. I'd rather go and die at home. Thank you very much. It's absolutely awful. And that's, you know, that's me as an adult. So, you know, for a child to be thrown into that.
I suppose that's what we know as well about James, who James's place is named after, or, you know, that's the whole purpose of us, is that he went to A&E, and however long he waited to be supported, to be seen, and he ended up leaving. So I think it goes from even A&E up to places like James's place. You know, the reason why we're so successful, apart from obviously the work that we do, is the environment, because it's not clinical. Yeah. It's not like the Royal or Whiston or Alder Hey. So the young people who were using our service, I feel, felt more at home at James's place, so that they weren't being seen by a professional. They were being seen by someone who wanted them to get better.
Well, to kind of finish off, I suppose, the episode now, it'd be great to hear about, you know, any feedback that your son gave, or any feedback that you know that came through anecdotally from any of the young men or their parents?
Claire became a bit of a lifesaver for my son, because I was still, and dad, we will share the blame for this, we were helicoptering over him. We were not giving him space. And it was like 4 or 5 weeks into his sessions, and he had come on such leap and bounds, and I hadn't noticed, and, you know, dad hadn't noticed, but my lad had noticed that we were continuously not giving him 5 minutes peace. So he came in, he was like, Claire. And we had to negotiate.
I remember that.
Do you remember? We had to negotiate how many times we knocked on his door. We had to, and she was going, well, so how many times do you think you're knocking? I'm probably about 6 times a night. And then he was like, yeah. And then dad, and I was like, oh yeah, he's just about to. And he's got quite a few siblings, and they'd be texting or ringing or turning up, and he was getting no downtime from us over caring. So we had to negotiate.
It was, because that was, I think it was near the ending of the intervention. Again, we were using the cards, and it was the grey cards, if you remember, which is, how can I get through this? So it's what I can do to help myself and what my supporter can do to help myself. So it was the first time, and I think it's the only time I've actually used those cards with a parent or a supporter, as well as the service user. And I sat them both down to do that. So I think you must be knocking on the door 6 times an hour, never mind 6 times a night. And it was getting too much for him.
Yeah.
So at that time, we wanted him to have that kind of like autonomy over his life. And I think then at that point, you saw that he was managing well. He'd made no other attempts. His cords, his ESF had all gone down. So we knew he was in a safe space for not only to be discharged, but for you and the rest of the family. And even the school, for that matter, to give him, or college, was it, to give him a bit more time to go about his business, so to speak, wasn't it?
I feel like you're starting a whole new episode of topic here, but a really interesting point, actually, of when to know as well that, okay, they're back in a safe place and we can feel comfortable.
We can breathe again.
To do that. And I can imagine, as a parent, why you were doing that. And I'm sure he understood. Yeah. So yeah, we'll keep having our pleas to commissioners and funders to highlight how important this age group is as well for us to provide this service for. But just want to say a massive thank you to all three of you to joining in the conversation. I think we could have sat here and talked for another 2 hours. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Let's Talk Hope, giving a voice to the unheard, brought to you by Professor Pooja Saini, head of the Suicide and Self-Harm Research Group at Liverpool John Moores University, and produced by Inabella Media. If you or someone you know has been affected by any of the issues discussed in this episode, please refer to the help and resources listed in the show notes for details of organisations that can provide support. Thanks for listening.